I'd like to take this opportunity, first of all, to introduce myself. My name's Debbie King, and along with my colleagues Maria Banalik and Lauren Chu, we work in association with Weber Training to provide you with this UK series of teleclasses. I'd like to welcome to speak to us today Yvonne Curran, who's a nurse consultant in infection control at Health Protection Scotland. Yvonne began working in infection control in 1998 at Glasgow Royal Infirmary and went on to become lead nurse for North Glasgow and infection control advisor to the NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde until taking up position as consultant nurse for Health Protection Scotland. Yvonne gained a diploma in infection control in 1990, a master's in public health in 1994, and is currently undertaking a clinical doctorate at Stirling University. Her special interests in infection control centre in the main around healthcare quality improvement and the use of quality improvement tools such as statistical process control charts to achieve sustained healthcare quality improvement. Research interests include surveillance, use of statistical process control charts to reduce alert organisms and needle stick injuries. Yvonne was one of the principal investigators on the chart project. Publications include articles on outbreaks, SPCs, TB, epidemiology and infection control planning. So I'd like to welcome Yvonne to take us through the presentation. Thanks, Yvonne.
Thank you very much, Debbie. First of all, thank you very much for inviting me to come and speak today. This is the first time I've done such a presentation, and it's very awkward not getting any visual clues from the audience to let me know if something was unclear or that it was very dull, so dull that people are sleeping, and there's no way to throw any chalk when you're doing a presentation down a phone, so it's a bit difficult. Also, I can't tell if I'm going through the presentation at such a rate of knots that steam's being emitted from pens and papers. With the mute buttons pressed, there's no opportunity for verbal feedback during the presentation, but hopefully we'll rectify that with some questions afterwards. I'll do my best to keep the time so that we can have a few questions afterwards if anything's unclear. So let's begin. I believe you've all had the presentation or got the presentation in front of you. The title is called Talking TB. We'll move to the first proper slide, which is why ask me. And the reason I put that there is just to say I don't consider myself to be a TB expert, but certainly being an infection control, hopefully expert, it is my role to make sure, or part of my role to make sure, that the environment is safe for practitioners to practice. And that includes when TB is suspected or is known to be present. Had written a few articles on respiratory protection for TB from the practitioner's perspective, and that's mainly because there are conundrums around to mask or not to mask or which mask to use. Some of you might have come across the care plan that we devised in Glasgow in the book by Pratt, Grange and Williams, TB, a Foundation for Nursing Healthcare. Might find that useful. So we'll move on to the next slide. I've been asked to consider respiratory protection when caring for patients with TB. And that's in the main what I'm going to focus on. But you can't just do respiratory protection for TB. You have to set it in the context, the overall context for TB. So moving to the next slide. In this presentation, what I'm going to be talking about is optimization of care for patients, because it's only when we optimise the care for patients with TB do we make the environment safe for practitioners. And so the focus must be on optimisation of care to make it safe for practitioners. And the other focus I want to make clear is understanding the science and the gaps in the science and why there is this variation in recommendations, particularly with guidance in the UK, and what does that mean for us who are asking people to use respiratory protection or maybe not. So we'll move to the next slide, and I just wanted to put this up because I think at the minute we have to consider the big context, the international context in which we practice healthcare. We are in a post-SARS and maybe post-SARS 1, pre-SARS 2, who knows. We are in a pre-next pandemic of influenza. We are potentially, but hopefully not, in a bioterrorism response. We are in a situation where community-acquired MRSA causing severe pneumonia has come with a recommendation that masks should be worn for intubation and physio. That makes it quite difficult because we don't know people have got that particular infection until a few days down the line. We're in an ever-evolving world of organisms. The organisms just evolve all the time. And we are also in the situation where we've got multidrug-resistant tuberculosis in an unknown number of patients. People do not arrive in casualty with a diagnosis tattooed on their head of I've got tuberculosis or I've got multidrug tuberculosis, in which we can then take appropriate care. We have to use our skills and our knowledge to make sure we can identify these, and we do procedures that identify them. So we're in a world where we cannot always identify for some considerable time the risk posed by patients with a respiratory infection, and that's where we are, and we have to just bear that in mind all the time. Moving to the next slide then, this is just a couple of slides illustrating the point. I just want to emphasise that it's complicated, and I always remember when I first started in infection control being bitterly disappointed. I thought this was going to be very clear. There was always going to be clear guidance on what we should do and what we shouldn't do, and it's not like that. So there is a warning out. It's complicated. We have to consider a lot of individual situations based on their own merit. For the next slide, this is just a simple one for TB care. You can apply this to any part of infection control at all. One size doesn't fit all. And maybe if one size did fit all, we wouldn't need so many infection control nurses. But one size certainly doesn't fit all. And the next adage on the next slide is that it's not black and white. There are many, many, many shades of grey. And we have to understand the complexity of the situation. One more adage which I think is really important, and that is, I remember it as Sue McQueen's favourite adage, and that's think globally and act locally. I never quite understood what it meant initially when I heard it, but in actual fact it's a perfect adage for the situation that we're in. It's very important that we understand and know what is going on planet Earth in terms of tuberculosis, the enormity of the problem of access to drugs, the problem of where people most have tuberculosis, and also where most drug-resistant tuberculosis is. But we have to act locally. You as individuals have to act locally, whether you're recommending action or whether you're actually participating in direct patient care. And that depends on the epidemiology of the situation where you practice. It depends on what resources you've got available to you in your environment. So think globally, understand the situation, and then how does that impact on how I practice is how you act locally. So the next slide further emphasizes this. You have to understand your local context. What you should do and what you should recommend depends on the risks presented in your establishment and the resources that you have to negate them. And that can't be emphasized enough. And clearly what that means is that you really have to know your local environment, your local risks, and what resources that you have. And we'll come on to talk about that a bit later on. I'm going to do a bit of the basics first of all. Mycobacterium tuberculosis causes MTB, causes a few other diseases as well, but it causes pulmonary tuberculosis. And the organism is disseminated on very small airborne droplet nuclei that remain suspended in the air. And we learned a few things over the SARS pandemic. We certainly learned that other droplets, slightly bigger than that, can remain suspended in the air, but these ones are important. These very small ones are important because they go right down into the alveoli of individuals. So they're inhaled directly into the alveoli. And in some people, not everybody, but in some people, infection develops. I'll move to the next slide. There's a couple of bits here that are red. And this is just to emphasize, it's very difficult to be sure what's going on. In TB, it's very difficult to be certain. So usually, somewhere between 2 and 12 weeks later, an immune response develops, and this suspends the disease development. So at this point, a patient's going to test positive, and they're going to be infected, but they will not be infectious, and they will not have TB disease. Viable Mycobacterium tuberculosis can remain lifelong in these patients, which can at some point in time be reactivated. Now, these people who've got infection, about 5 to 10% of them, will go on at some point in their lives to get TB disease. And most of the people that go on to get it will get it within the first 5 to 10 years of actually becoming infected. But again, not clear who's going to get it, not clear when they're going to get it. We shall move on. Now, the clear distinction that has to be crystal clear in your mind is the distinction between TB infection and TB disease. So TB infection is a condition in which the TB, the tubercle bacilli, are present in the body, but the disease is not clinically active. These patients have a positive test reaction, but they don't have symptoms and they're not infectious. TB disease is a clinically active symptomatic disease caused by the organism. Okay, re-emphasize this on the next slide. TB infection, asymptomatic, not infectious. It can progress to TB disease, but we don't know in whom that's going to happen. TB disease is symptomatic, and these people are infectious. But just how infectious they are varies. And that's another one of these shades of grey that we don't quite have a clear picture on. On to the next slide. The probability that a person exposed to TB gets TB infection depends on the concentration of organisms in the air and how long they're in there. And quite clearly, the longer they're exposed and the closer proximity, the greater the risk. It's that simple. But the problem is, we don't know how concentrated the air is with the droplet nuclei. We might be able to measure clearly how long they've been exposed, but we don't know quite what they've been exposed to. Those that are at higher risk of infection are the close contacts of a family. Now, we tend to think of a family as mum, dad and two children, but it might be what I've called a pub family. Where do these people socially live with? This might not be as tradition. People at higher risk of infection are also, the two italics under the next bullet points, are healthcare workers who serve populations at higher risk, and healthcare workers with unprotected exposure to a patient with TB disease before precautions are instigated. And those two come directly from the CDC.gov guidance. Cannot emphasize those two enough. People living in overcrowded conditions or poor facilities, and infants and children of adults with TB disease, also at higher risk of infection. Now, the probability on the next slide, the probability that a patient with TB infection goes on to get TB disease depends on how exposed they are and how good their immune system is. So the greater the exposure, it doesn't matter how poor your immune system is, you can be overcome. And I know one or two very healthy people who did not have a poor immune system, but they got so much exposure that they went on to get TB disease. So any of the immune system function disorders can increase the risk of somebody with TB infection going on to getting TB disease. But it doesn't mean just because you've got a poor immune function that you can't go on to get it. So I've got a slide just on understanding the results next. We have to remember that TB grows very slowly in the lab as well as in the person. And so we're not looking for colonies of the organisms initially. What we're looking for is a smear test to see whether they can be seen on a stain. Now, it actually takes only 30 minutes for this test to be done. It might take an awful lot of time to get the specimen to the lab. It might take an awful lot of time before they decide to process it, but the actual time taken to do a test is about 30 minutes. And this smear test distinguishes infectious TB from TB which is currently not thought to be infectious. We get a lot of comfort from smear negative TB. Culture results come later. Now, it was 6 weeks, it's down to 2 weeks, and it's on a kind of slide down now because they are getting much more better tests at making cutting this time period down, time from when the when we can grow the organism. And that's very important, particularly when we're concerned about drug-resistant tuberculosis. The smear test result determines the infectiousness. And as I've said already, that these tests are being sped up. Now, smear positive equals infectious. Smear negative but culture positive equals a low infectivity risk. You don't tend to get the all clear the way we would like it. So smear positive equals infections. Smear negative but culture positive, this is going to come, remember, 2 to 6 weeks later, means a low infectivity risk. But might be if a patient is in an environment where there are immunocompromised patients, that's actually quite a big risk to these patients. Okay, what are the symptoms? Unexplained cough lasting more than 3 weeks with or without these other symptoms. Fever and night sweats, classic signs, weight loss and anorexia and hemoptysis. Now these are classic signs of TB, and most assessments on admission seem to look for them. Whether they actually act on them when they're found is another matter, and we'll talk about that a bit later on. We know from the literature that these classic signs are easy to miss. We know they're easy to miss because most of the outbreaks occur because they have been missed. So despite the fact that might be well documented in the notes, the adding up of the cough, the weight loss, the hemoptysis, and the fever and the night sweat, adding it up to equal potential TB, not always done, and we have to think about that very carefully within our facilities. Okay. Pulmonary TB is a slowly progressive chronic infection, usually of the lungs, but any organism can be affected. But we only consider TB to be infectious. And I'll say that with a slight caveat because there is at least one paper in the literature where in the middle of an operation they were doing irrigation of a wound, and that wound was actually a tuberculous cavity, and people in the room who were doing that procedure became infected with TB. So we have to bear that in mind. There are factors which increase the risk of infectiousness. Does the patient have a cough? The patient has a cavitation on X-ray. The patient's smear positive. There's involvement of the larynx. If they don't comply with hand over the mouth when coughing, if they've had poor antimicrobial therapy, they're not taking all their drugs. We're doing aerosol-generating procedures such as sputum induction or aerosolized medication. These seem to increase the risk of the amount of TB that will be disseminated into the air. And when I worked at the Brompton Hospital many years ago now, in the connecting corridor between the old and the new part of the hospital were little indents in the wall. And in the wall is where they used to keep, in these little indents, is where they used to keep a sputum pot and tissues. And if you didn't spit into the sputum pot, then you were expelled from the hospital. And really strict compliance was necessary with that simple measure. So these are the factors that increase the risk of infectiousness. Now, here are the $64,000 questions. Do patients with TB disease pose a risk to other patients? Do patients with TB disease pose a risk to healthcare workers? And do they pose a risk to visitors? If the answer to these questions is no, we don't need to hang on for the rest of the teleclass. But we know from the evidence in the literature that it's yes. Okay? Yes, they pose a risk to other patients. Yes, they pose a risk to healthcare workers, and even potentially to visitors. And that's provided we don't take adequate care. There is one paper I'm going to talk about a bit later on which suggests that even with all measures taken, that we cannot exclude the risk. And that's why we need to take respiratory protection. Go on to the next slide then. Okay, is TB a risk to other patients? Well, you only have to put in your TB outbreak and hospital into your search engine and up will come a list of reports of various outbreaks. So TB outbreak reports continue to be published in the literature, and the main now involving nursing homes and long-term care places. And I remember a colleague telling me about an outbreak of tuberculosis that happened in one of her long-term care facilities, and it was only recognised that a patient was losing weight and generally getting debilitated when somebody who used to be in that ward came back about 6 months later, and this patient had lost so much weight. Investigation was done and the patient had TB. So it's easy to see how there can be a long-term exposure in these facilities, and obviously the greater the exposure, the greater the likelihood that there is a risk to other patients or other persons living in the establishment. We also have outbreaks of wards, outbreak reports in wards relating to patients with HIV disease or other immune-suppressing disease. These are quite common in the literature, and obviously the literature is an underreported mechanism. Now, I didn't expect to find anything when I was looking up for our visitors at risk, but I actually did find one reported incident of an outbreak where one of the visitors 2 years later was diagnosed with tuberculosis. And one of the advantages of the DNA and the latest testing with regard to TB is that we're going to get better track records of where TB or the TB originally came from. And so we'll be able to make better links, because 2 years later, nobody might have suspected that was in fact related to an earlier outbreak of visiting a hospital, but in fact that was the case. So that's the reference there for you. So is it a risk to healthcare workers? Well, when I first wrote an article on do healthcare workers need to wear a mask, it became quite clear that post-mortem staff, particularly pathologists, were at the highest risk. Doing post-mortem, cutting into lung tissue when there's an unsuspected case of tuberculosis would result in a very high release of tubercle bacilli. With all of the changes with regard to tissues, postmortems are not often done these days. So that risk will come down and should be considered past high risk. Basically depends on how good the care is. But outbreaks are common when TB is not suspected, basic care is not taken, treatment is not started early, and during high-risk procedures, where the high risk was not identified, as I've already mentioned, irrigating a wound. Now, there's three papers I wouldn't mind drawing to your attention. One is by Meredith et al. In the BMJ in 1996, and she looked at tuberculosis amongst professional categories, and what they found was that healthcare workers had a higher rate, significantly higher rate, of TB than did other professionals. Other professionals that obviously weren't in healthcare. So this made them suggest and conclude that there needs to be increased monitoring and that healthcare workers remained a risk, that it was an occupational hazard. There's another paper in Respiratory Medicine in 2002 by a group of people from Turkey. I can't pronounce it correctly, I apologise for that, but it's K-I-L-N-C. And their conclusion was that in Turkey, these findings suggest that TB can be considered an occupational disease, and that was certainly the point that Meredith, I think, was trying to make. And there's one further paper, and this was in Emerging Infectious Diseases in 1997, where Gamatuni and Nucci did some mathematical modelling on tuberculosis, and their conclusion was that their mathematical model indicated that a certain number of persons exposed to a source of TB infection. We'll be infected despite of all precautions. So we have to say from that, from these papers, that TB and healthcare workers remain a risk. So let's re-emphasise again, why do these outbreaks occur amongst healthcare workers being exposed? And it was a failure to recognise the signs and symptoms of tuberculosis early, particularly when sputum induction procedures were done on the main ward. There's one other situation which I think is always worth mentioning. I'm always astounded at the amount of, or lack of evidence of clinical waste being causing infection. But there is one instance where reported in JAMA in 2000 where there was transmission of tuberculosis from contaminated waste, and actually was traced back to laboratories sending waste off to be processed that wasn't fit for going through that procedure. And hopefully with the accreditation and the processes that have to go in laboratory, this is a one-off. But it just shows you that it can occur. Now, all of these situations take us back to optimization of care and making the environment safe. On the next slide, what do we have to do to optimize care and make this environment safe? Right, here's a list of our action required. We must recognize early that a patient could have infection. There must be early assessment for drug resistance. Certainly if we suspect TB, the next question should be on the potential risk from drug resistance. We should isolate our patients early. We should send specimens to lab as soon as possible. And not only must we send them to the lab urgently, we must ask the lab to process them urgently. We'll talk a bit about that. We must have early instigation of therapy. We must have early referral to a respiratory physician and to a tuberculosis nurse. Not everybody has them. Some of the big cities still do, others not. Early referral to public health. And we must ensure that there are no sputum-inducing procedures done on the main wards. We must also have use of close-fitting respiratory and not surgical masks for prolonged care, and in particular for any aerosol-generating procedures. So let's take a look at some of these individually. Early recognition is number one. All patients should be assessed for all infection risks on admission. I just did a piece of work for another project, and I looked at how good we are at assessing infection risk. And at the moment, in particular in nursing, we might find, and I encourage you to do this, is to go look at your proformas. You might find a separate proforma for a weight loss risk, for nutrition, for pressure sore risk, a risk of falls, a general activities of daily living. And a lot of these assessments are asking the same question, but they're not asking it and leading the person who's filling out the form to come to any conclusions with regard to infection. I found if you took TB for an example, you would find that the weight loss would be on the nutrition section. You would find cough might be on activities of daily living, but there was nothing drawing the reader to bring it all together. And I think there's a big piece of work to be done to get some electronic assistance for assessment, so we ask all of the right questions, we ask them only once, and we come up with a proper risk assessment which can deal with weight loss, pressure sores, all the different things that we need to do, but it includes infection risk. So again, your proforma should look for direct questions for cough, weight loss, night sweats, tumopathies. We should be looking for follow-up questions if any of these are positive, and these are the questions for risk assessment for drug-resistant tuberculosis. So these are very important. Have a look at your performers and see if they would direct these questions to be asked. A lot of the nursing questions in particular tend to lose the opportunity for qualitative information, and perhaps we need to make them a bit more quantitative. Early isolation is the next slide. And this is in particular whilst assessment's going on. I think we have to think about, are these people coming in through A&E, through medical receiving? Where do we do assessments of patients with respiratory conditions? And do we do them in places that are equipped? What's the airflow in these places? And this is something that we need to know. We don't keep people in hospitals unless necessary, people who've got tuberculosis. One of the things that means is when we do have people in hospital with tuberculosis, they tend to be perhaps the most infectious, perhaps the most high risk of drug-resistant tuberculosis. But the key thing is, in the assessment facility, getting them to the team, to the respiratory physician and the TB nurse, and early isolation. Now, I've put down here, isolation equals a room with four walls, a door, a ceiling, preferably with negative pressure. Now, this might be stating the obvious, but I have been told at several times in my career that a room is an isolation facility when the door is in fact a curtain, when it's a partitioned area and it has no ceiling, and when one of the walls have been missing. So an isolation facility should have all of these facilities. And if we are looking after people with TB, particularly in the UK, I can see no reason why we don't have some facilities for negative pressure within our hospitals. And what you have to decide is, what facilities do you have, and what facilities do you need, and what's the gap? And even when you have got facilities that are okay, that you think have got negative pressure, how do you know that the negative pressure is working? That's a key point. There's lots of times I've been told that room is negatively pressured. How do we know? And I ask you the same question. Simple slide here, that patient might be in a negative pressure room, but the door's open, and in which case we don't have any reason to have a negative pressure, because there's no point. If you're going to have TB, patients looked after properly, they're in a room and the door is closed. The isolation room door is closed. Now we have to bring into play all our care, psychological care for these patients. Very important, very important. We have to ask for their cooperation, because it's like torture being in an isolation room for some people. But nevertheless, whilst they're infectious, the door remains closed. Next slide. How long must isolation precautions be applied? We should have until they're confirmed as having negative sputum, or if they're smear positive, 14 days therapy and definite clinical improvement. That means the patient is better, looks better, feels better. And then after this, provided there are no immunocompromised patients in the area, you can discharge the patient from isolation. There are immunocompromised patients, still wouldn't bring the patient out. The reason that the definite clinical improvement is there, some people will have some non-viable sputum, some non-viable TB in their smear test, and that makes it difficult to interpret. So the clinical improvement is vital. But again, this consideration of where they're going is important. Now, I think for these type of patients, we do need a care plan. So I've got a care plan, or the main contents of a care plan are the next two slides. Now, this care plan is the one that was published in the Pratt & Granger TB, a Foundation for Healthcare Practice. But I'm quite happy to give this one to Debbie to disseminate to those who are at this today. This is just a care plan that we found useful, or these are the key elements. The potential problems down the left-hand side, the unconfirmed diagnosis. Number one, we confirm the diagnosis, we send the sputums, and those are our signatures by it. We must assess and document the possibility of drug resistance is the next one. And after that is the cross-infection to patients. patients understanding the disease, potential problems of failing to comply with therapy. And this are all the actions that you need to do. We found this extremely useful in handing this over. People could adapt it to local needs. They could stop it if they had 3 negative smears, or they could continue through and record their care on it if they wanted to do. So this was a care plan that we find useful. It hasn't come out exactly right on this slide, and I apologise for that. There's a couple of blurred bits, but nevertheless, the key elements are there. We do have cross-infection to visitors on it, and we do have cross-infection to staff on it. And also on it, we have the discharge care planning. So everything related to infection prevention and control with regard to TB should be here. And if you don't need to do that, if it's not written down, you don't need to do it, is the way we did it. So this was the way that we ensured that the care delivered on the ward was optimal. In different settings, in different situations, it could be adapted depending on your local situation. But you might find this type of thing useful, or a useful starter for 10 in making up your own one. So our next, I'm not going to focus on each little bit of the care plan. It's there for you to use. Consider it a serving suggestion. So let's take a look at specimens. We've said they should be urgently taken and they should be urgently processed. TB clinicians used to tell me that it is okay to do it on the same day, but it's not okay to do it from the same spit. So that's what you should do. Now, what you should find out is, how long does that take in your facility? How long does it take to get a TB sample back on average? And that's a nice little audit program to see if you can assess that and see if you can improve that. And the next question that you should be finding out is, how long does it take if a patient's admitted at 5 p.m. on a bank holiday Friday? Because outbreaks, as we always know, are encouraged to take place over bank holiday weekends, when specimens aren't processed unless they're marked urgent, when you don't get the right transport facilities available. So if it's not down in the lab by 1 o'clock, it's not going to get done till Tuesday. That's not what sort of care that we're looking at with regard to specimens at this time. So part of your respiratory assessment is key to that question. And the next question, and the next slide is regard to therapy. We said therapy should be early, and we've all got door to needle time care for people with clot busters. But how long does it take to get the first dose of TB in patients who clearly got signs and symptoms? It should be, or it certainly could be, a couple of hours. But again, another useful audit, or if you've got somebody who wants to do a healthcare quality improvement project in an infection control area, here's a nice one. Should be a couple of hours. How long does it take? And remember, we want urgent referral to a respiratory physician and TB nurse if you have one. So here's another danger signal on the next slide. The patient has no spit. Get the physio, do a sputum induction, and there's an error assumption here. No diagnosis of TB, therefore no risk and no precautions required. So questions for you again. Where's sputum induction done in your facility? Where is it done in medical receiving? And what are the air changes available in this area? And who is at risk as a consequence? These are key questions for you to consider if you're in a kind of infection control situation and you're looking after people. So that's very important, because we know treatment induction is risk, and it's always going to come in one of these patients who are not obviously TB. So the next slide's got danger 2 on it, and this is, patient doesn't have recognised factors for MDR-TB, but there's no improvement after 2 weeks therapy. And probably we've been slightly getting lax over week 2, because, hey, they've only got another week to go and they can be out of isolation. But this will happen. Patients will have TB, but they might not have the risk factors. And we have to be prepared for that. That's why we have to advocate the latest tests to tell us the drug resistance as early as possible, because this is a key problem. Now, if we could guarantee, moved on to the next slide now, if we could guarantee optimal care, do healthcare workers need to wear masks for non-NDR-TB? And certainly the risk would be very low, but there is still evidence from the literature, which I've referred you to today, suggesting we cannot eliminate this risk. Optimal care is quite clearly early diagnosis, isolation, in negative pressure, which has got indications of working, therapy and compliance. Now, there will be people who will say, we've never worn TB masks, we've never advocated TB masks, and we've never had a problem. Well, we can wait and we can get a problem, or we can do what we need to do to eliminate that risk of problems occurring, and that would be my standpoint. And now, I've moved on to the next slide now. I always liked this, and I probably was the only one in the world, me and Donald Rumsfeld, who liked his statement, there are things we know, and things we know we don't know, and things we don't know we know. And it was a very ambiguous statement. But it's actually, if you stop and break it down, it's actually quite sensible. However, it did turn out that even the things that they knew, they didn't know, but that's beside the point. What's all this got to do with TB? Well, what do we know? We know the patient probably has TB, or definitely has TB. We might know that if we've got our smear test back. What we don't know is on the next slide. We don't know if it's drug resistant until the sensitivities are back, or until there's been no response to therapy. We don't really know how infectious the patient is. And unless we've got a continuously gauged monitor on the ventilation in the room, we don't know that the ventilation is optimal. And that's very important, and that's the problem. This is the slide that tells us we need to be wearing respiratory protection. To prevent outbreaks, we need administrative controls, and I would say to you, go and check what do you have, what do you do, and what do you have, and what quality assurance do you have on those controls? We've talked a few about some of them. We've got to have clinical controls. What is our time to isolation and time to therapy? What are the engineering controls that we need, and are they sufficient for patient population? And what you need for that is you need to know how many people are admitted to my hospitals with TB, and how many days do they remain in the hospital throughout the year. And that's the kind of information that you need and you should be routinely collecting if you're in infection control. And we also need personal protective equipment. Okay. For all of that, you must have a respiratory assessment for your facility. I wouldn't do it for tuberculosis alone now. I would do it for respiratory infections in general. We have to consider that our frontline medical receiving areas will get some nasty respiratory infections that do go person to person from time to time, and we should have facilities and environments which are safe to do that. You can consider on the next slide headings for a assessment with regard to the people, what people come in, how often do they come in, members of the public, healthcare workers, what have we got, are they vulnerable, how vulnerable are they? So that's one heading. Environment is another setting. Is it controlled or is it uncontrolled? What are the procedures that you have? Everything from processing specimens to getting therapy started immediately. And what equipment do you have with regard to decontamination and PPE? Now, there's good examples in all of the guidelines that are quoted, and you've got web links at the back. Good examples on how to do a respiratory assessment. You can use whatever system that you want, so long as you cover all the bases. Now, here's our big conundrum question. Should healthcare workers wear masks? And the question that we should ask as a consequence is, well, what does the evidence say? The evidence says that healthcare workers are at risk, that the risk is significantly reduced by optimal care, and that optimal care we've talked about. But it also says that the risk cannot be eliminated by these controls alone. So these are some of the guidelines that are out there for us to consider and to follow. We've got guidelines for the prevention of tuberculosis in healthcare facilities with resource-limited settings. We've got the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence guidelines. We've got the CDC guidelines. We've got the Interdepartmental Working Group Departments of Health guidelines in the UK. I've put an Australian guideline there, and the UK United Kingdom Code of Practice, which came out from the British Thoracic Society. So these are the main guidelines that were reviewed in trying to ask these questions. Now, on the next slide, which says what do the guidelines say, what you see in the first column is the year they were published. You can see the author. You can see whether they recommend masks for general care, whether they recommend them for aerosol-generating procedures, whether they recommend them for TB, and the final slide is any additional comments. And the key thing to emphasise here is that the NICE UK guidance and the UK Thoracic Code of Practice Society guidance does not recommend or advocate respiratory protection for general care. It does recommend them for aerosol-generating procedures, does recommend them for MDR-TB. One of the key points there is that the World Health Organization recommendations for healthcare in countries with limited resources recommends them for general care. So we're actually being, the UK, the guidance is different in these. Also another key point, the UK Department of Health guidance in 1998 also recommended wearing masks. So that's the conundrum, and we'll come on to talk about that in a minute. The next slide we'll see what they recommend, and I've included the page numbers, so these guidelines are all available on the web, and these are the masks that they need. One of the problems in the UK is that America nailed its colours to the wall and said this is the mask, N95 mask. That's effective. There's no European equivalent N95 standard, and so people were reluctant to go less than was required in America, and as a consequence went to a mask that is higher. The World Health Organization, the CDC on Australia are all given the guidance on roughly the same, and it's really only the fact that there is this technical mismatch of standard equivalence, if you will, that has changed, that makes that recommendation. So that's what they're saying with regard to what mask you should wear and when you should wear it. On the next slide, we look for a reason for the difference between general care for patients who don't have drug tuberculosis, i.e. entering a room, and for those with drug-sensitive tuberculosis. Key question is it any more infectious? And the answer to that is no. It's no more infectious to get MDR-TB. It's certainly correct to say that people with MDR-TB will be infectious for longer, but the actual amount of TB in the air is no more infectious for drug-sensitive than for drug-resistant tuberculosis. So that's not an argument. So the question is, if they work for drug-sensitive, would they not work for drug... if they work for drug resistant, would they not work for drug sensitive? Or is it just a kind of to be sure that we've put this on? And that leads us to the middle question then, is it acceptable for healthcare workers to get drug sensitive TB or to be exposed to drug sensitive TB is probably what we should be saying to that. And I would argue that if they're recommending masks for multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, we have to recommend masks for drug-sensitive tuberculosis. It becomes illogical to have any other type of situation. So, on our next slide, we've got cans of worms. It should be rather than a can of worms or cans of worms issues. Masks and where to put them, because they're very good when you're sanding down and things at home, and certainly most of the masks in the UK are originally designed for decorating more than protecting healthcare workers, so they might all go walk about. We have the thorny issue of fit testing, because the Health and Safety Executive guidelines say that if you require to wear a mask of the standards, then you require fit testing. We require training for these people in terms of how to put on a mask and when to put on a mask. And we also have the thorny issue of beards. Do we make respiratory physicians shave off their beards? And the other cans of worm is the cost and who's going to pay for it. Now, how do we progress these very difficult and thorny issues? The first thing we have to do, and I am on to the next slide now, is quantify the size of a problem. And we do that through a respiratory assessment. We have to get a handle on the size of the problem. I can't just think it's never going to be tackled if we don't quantify it and put it down on paper. We have to bring it to the risk management clinical governance collectively. You can get it on the register if it's required. Here is the situation. What are we going to do about it? And I just throw this into the kind of debate. I think, are we where we were in the should we all wear blood and body fluids for gloves for blood and body fluids? Only this time it's respiratory protection. I'm old enough to remember when we didn't wear gloves for blood and body fluid. I think we've just got to change the environment in the UK. We escaped relatively easily with SARS, and we've not been faced with something that's really quite big. If we get our risk assessment of respiratory risk assessment right, and we get it addressed and quantify the problem through the risk management, I think it can be managed. We also need clear uniform guidance. We can't have guidance which contradicts other guidance, or we need better evidence, and somebody needs to commission some research so that it becomes black and white, and we eliminate some of these shades of grey that are there. So I've got some key points. Optimal care is required for effective protection of staff. And if anyone asks, how do we protect our staff? Protect our staff by optimally caring for our patients. And that involves early clinical assessment, diagnosis, therapy, isolation, and public health. We need engineering controls, and these must be effective and obvious. We must have a sign that says this is working or it's not working. And respiratory protection, I think we do need respiratory protection until the risk is negated, or we can be clear and assured that the risk is negated. And the other key point is, at the minute, the evidence-based guidelines are not in agreement, and they're particularly related to the UK guidelines. So that is where I'm going to stop. I thank you for your attention, and I just leave you with a slide which has got all of the links to these guidelines that we have talked about, or I have talked about in the presentation.
Thanks very much, Yvonne. That was a fantastic presentation. Oh. Really enjoyed it. So thank you very much for that, and I'm sure everyone out there is in the same boat. If nobody minds, I'm going to take chair's privilege and just ask one question. Yvonne, in one of your early slides about action required, you referred to prolonged care for wearing masks.
Yeah.
This is always a very thorny issue,
yeah.
Because what do you define as prolonged care?
Yeah.
And obviously, you've partly covered it in a later one where some of the guidelines are saying no masks at all, but what would your definition
yeah,
be?
I think if you're going, I mean, sometimes the patients that we have in now are the sickest. They are fully dependent patients. If you're going in and you're doing the bed, bath, the entire care works, and you're going to be in there to do that, you're going to be there for some time. I would put a mask on for that one. Mm-hmm. I think if you're going in, putting a cup of tea down and going out again, I don't see that it's a problem. So that's the way I would do it. Whenever you get the situation where some people do and some people don't, the patient gets mixed messages.
Mm, absolutely.
And so you do have that problem. But again, if we communicate the situation, when I'm in here for a long period of time or a nurse is in here for a long period of time, such as what I'm doing now, we will be wearing masks. Mm. But if we pop in and out, we don't consider a mask necessary to do that. That would be a reasonable way to overcome that situation. As always, communication is everything.
Absolutely.
Making sure everyone understands what we're doing and why it's different.